Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs, bringing you 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live right now and then you can catch us later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates that you need, fast and focused. It's Friday, the 30th of August. Coming up on the program, more on South Africa's airport instruments problem, the state of lottery corruption in South Africa, why the price of potatoes is climbing, and is the road to the next Rugby World Cup already being trodden? On the program yesterday, an extensive interview with the Transport Minister, Barbara Creasy, about flight delays owing to outdated instrument flight procedures. According to Air Traffic and Navigation Services, it's now undertaken a process to find the cause of the problem and provide a solution. So let's explore that in a little more detail. Joining us now from ATNS is Mpilo Dlamini, Head of Corporate Affairs and Communication. And what exactly then caused the suspension of these instrument flight procedures at what I understand are multiple airports?
First and foremost, let me just explain what are instrument flight procedures. These are the systems that pilots or aircraft use to land in cases where it's either dark or it's during inclement weather patterns. So they are very, very critical for aircrafts in terms of landing and also in terms of departing. So they have been suspended because they need to be updated at certain periods of times. The reason for the updates is because they have to comply with the South African Civil Aviation Authority regulations as well as ICAO regulations. So those are the reasons why they are suspended. And then in terms of our safety management system, Jeremy, procedures that do not meet those requirements should be suspended unless non-compliances are mitigated. So that is the reason. So why we are doing that actually again is to make sure that we prioritize safety, you know, so that we can upgrade our system so that safety is prioritized. South Africa has got a good track record in terms of aviation safety, so we don't want to compromise that at any given time.
And
so
there's no argument as far as compromising on safety is concerned, but this does beg the question as to why these important issues, and there are many of them, were not identified and addressed before they led to widespread flight disruptions.
Yeah, there are various factors that caused, you know, in terms of the backlog. The first one was the issue of capacity. Flight procedure design specialists are very scarce globally. So we were also struggling, you know, in terms of capacity around that. And the ones that we have trained and developed, you will find that they are pushed out of South Africa to work in the Asians or into the Arab world or in the Middle East and in the Americas. So we are struggling with flight procedure design specialists. That's one thing. The second thing, we had our maintenance plan backlog disturbed by COVID-19. You know, so the recovery from there has been very, very difficult, Jeremy, I must admit. And all of us are still recovering from that hit in terms of COVID-19. So those are the two factors that actually have contributed to the backlog. Otherwise, there is progress. I can actually report to your audience that there is progress, and it's a remarkable progress. For instance, at George, you know, some of the suspended procedures have been lifted, or Tambo as well. We have seen the same thing happening in Cape Town. Polokwane, Kimberley, also, they are coming up okay in terms of being sorted. So there is remarkable progress, Jeremy.
But how can you still be blaming COVID 3 years on?
Generally, COVID, the impact of COVID, all of us, the economy still recovering from COVID, all aspects of the economy are still recovering from COVID, and we are no exception to that. So that is why I'm putting this forward, that it has affected us and it has contributed to the current backlog that we have in terms of maintaining and updating our procedures.
The minister wants a plan on how you're going to get this right, and she's been very tight with a deadline sometime next week. Are you going to be able to deliver that, or have you delivered it already?
We are going to deliver the plan as per the minister, who is actually providing a wonderful oversight to the entity, and we are going to comply in terms of the timelines that she has set for us, and we shall deliver that comprehensive plan.
Does your plan address the critical skills shortage?
Actually, the plan has got a number of components inside. One of them is the issue of capacity, which is the critical skills that we need. Also, it has got the timelines in terms of when we can get those skills on board in South Africa working on this. And the third component is the issue of the investment, the cost of having those critical skills. And obviously, the other one has to talk about the commencement date as to when they can start working. So those are some of the components that are actually included in the comprehensive plan.
Where exactly are you going to find these skills?
The skills, Jeremy, they are all over the world, actually. Let me make an example. Currently, we have about four procedure designers that are originally from South Africa, but now they are working overseas. We had to bring them back from overseas because, like I'm saying, they are highly skilled and they are highly marketable. They are high on demand. So that is why we are getting them from overseas. And we have them. Some of them are here already. They have started working. We want to actually add more so that we can increase the capacity and fast-track the program, the maintenance program. And another thing that we have done, Jeremy, we have also trained about five of them. And training procedure designers is a very, very difficult and complex process. We have done that. Sometimes we have to take them to overseas, to Switzerland, for training and bring them back for on-the-job training and take them back again. So it's been a process. But five of them, they are actually being trained internally besides the four that we have actually contracted from overseas. So there's a lot of work that we are doing in terms of capacitating the area of skills, Jeremy.
You say that progress has been made. Are you able to provide to me a clear deadline for when all suspended procedures will be fully operational?
It is very difficult, actually, to put my head on the block regarding that in terms of the timelines as to when are they all going to be fully uplifted because of a number of reasons. One is the issue that I've just mentioned, that we are trying to source capacity in terms of the skills that are going to sort this matter. So that is one thing. The second thing that is becoming an issue is to make sure that everything that we do it thoroughly. We make sure that we don't cut corners. We make sure that we don't compromise on safety. So sometimes there's back and forth in terms of, submitting for approval, and we have to correct certain things because it's a complex thing and we do not want to cut corners. So it's very difficult actually to put a timeline on that. But we are going to work on it to make sure that it is done as speedily as possible. There is procedures that we call priority procedures. Those are the procedures that are in airports when they are affected a lot by the inclement weather patterns, like your George, your Cape Town, Bulugwane. So those are the ones that we are prioritizing, and we're making sure that we are going to sort those ones as a matter of priority. So, but in terms of the timelines for all of them, I can't have that as a matter of fact.
Maybe you could tell me then what the estimated cost of updating and resubmitting the instrument flight procedures is going to be, aside from the money that you're going to spend on recruiting or bringing back new skills.
Let me not preempt the comprehensive plan that we are going to submit to the minister, Jeremy. Please allow us to submit the plan to the minister, and then I think if the minister feels comfortable, she is going to be the one sharing that plan, because I think the cost and everything that is involved in terms of capital investment will be included in the plan.
Mpilo Dlamini, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday.
for all your up-to-date stories.
Attention, all investors and finance enthusiasts. Get ready for the annual Money Summit, Africa's largest and most influential savings and investment event. Join me, Jeremy Maggs, on Tuesday, the 10th of September at the Sandton Convention Centre as we connect with over 100 top chief executives and industry leaders across 20 exciting conferences and forums, all in one incredible day. Secure your spot now. Register online at www.moneysummit.co.za for free with the code MONEYWEBGUEST. This is your chance to be part of Africa's premier savings and investment event. Don't miss it.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
This is an extract from an article in Ground Up, Two Luxury Homes, a Property in an Upmarket Estate, a Poultry Farm, a Hilux SUV, all allegedly bought with funds siphoned from lottery grants, have been frozen by a preservation order granted by the High Court in Pretoria. The Special Investigating Unit and the Asset Forfeiture Unit were granted the orders after an ex parte hearing. I'm in conversation now with Karam Singh, Executive Director at Corruption Watch. And what is the scale of corruption uncovered in the lottery fund scandal, of which this is applicable to, those assets that have been seized, reveal about the broader state of corruption in South Africa? You must be concerned.
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. I mean, this is the scale of the national lottery's corruption is immense. I mean, if we just look at the SIU investigation, you know, you're looking at billions of rands that are under investigation in just a, you know, a snapshot period between 2014 and 2020, which is the period of the proclamation. I mean, there have been exposés on this for years in Ground Up, primarily from some really tenacious investigative journalists. I think it points to, you know, real weaknesses within the state that were laid to bear broadly in the Zondo Commission on state capture when it comes to, you know, different types of funds, different groupings of investments, of budgets, which are just absolutely vulnerable to corrupt schemes. And you can imagine, you know, the amount of revenue that's coming into the lotteries and then what was expected. If you don't have basic kind of good governance arrangements in play, then you see what transpired here, which has been, you know, as Zondo described it in other contexts, industrial scale looting. Yeah.
So I think the question is pertinent then about the environment within the NLC, the National Lotteries Commission, that allows such extensive corruption to flourish.
It's about capturing the executive of the organization and then ensuring that you have a compliant board, or in this case, you had a board that was actually actively benefiting from these kind of corrupt schemes. So, you know, it goes down then to basic kind of corporate governance. But the fact that this could have gone on for so many years without it being properly detected, without it being properly investigated. I mean, it took a long time, you know, for the SIU to even get their proclamation. This stuff had been in the public domain for years in terms of the work of investigative journalism. So, I mean, it is a cautionary tale, I think, going forward when we look at, you know, do a risk analysis across the state to say, where are the big budgets? Are processes vulnerable to corruption? And this is why there's been so much of a focus on procurement, because procurement is generally where the big money gets spent by the state. And if you can capture those processes, then you can, you know, divert monies for private gains.
And you're absolutely right about the SIU itself and the prosecutions being so slow. This particular organization hasn't covered itself with glory either.
Well, you know, I mean, the SIU has got a limited mandate. You know, the SIU is a special purpose organization, a creature of statute that has a mandate to recover assets on behalf of the state as a result of corruption, maladministration, fraud. They don't have criminal jurisdiction. When they have uncovered criminality in their investigations, they've got to hand those over to the hawks and to the MPA. And we know that, you know, the upper echelons of the police and the prosecution services have been extremely challenged when it comes to pursuing these kinds of high-level, white-collar prosecutions. So, yeah, I mean, there are challenges in the criminal justice system and real frustrations, you know, that a matter like this, we haven't seen any real significant prosecution.
But what it also says is that better coordination is needed between investigative bodies like the SIU, the Hawks, and the NPA to improve and to expedite justice.
Absolutely. And if we look at the reform agenda, you know, from an anti-corruption perspective, of sort of what we need to do to move the country forward, we need this kind of dedicated anti-corruption agency that becomes the coordination point. I mean, the SIU is bursting at the seams in terms of its mandate. I mean, it could be that the anti-corruption agency gets organized around the SIU, but we need that coordination. This is also why the independent directorate was set up in the MPA, to ensure there is this kind of prosecution-led investigations, because what we're seeing is these complex cases happen, the investigations get stalled, eventually the matters get to court, and then, you know, then there are problems, you know, when the matters get enrolled because of the chain of evidence or because the way, you know, the way in which the matters were insufficiently investigated.
Let me bring it back to the National Lotteries Commission. Are there systemic changes that are needed within the structures to prevent future corruption of this magnitude?
It's an important question, and probably a question that needs to be put to the new board, you know, the relatively new board of the National Lotteries Commission. I think there have been some important appointments made there. I think the SIU must finish its work, and I think we'll see systemic recommendations coming out of the SIU's report as well. But certainly, you know, there has to be some kind of oversight over what was Parliament doing all this time. You know, certainly Parliament has a role when it comes to oversight of how money gets spent in the public sector. So, you know, I mean, I don't know that this is necessarily a failure of oversight broadly within the system. But if we go forward, we want to see a board of the National Lotteries Commission that's properly accountable to the minister, that the minister's properly accountable to Parliament. And then when, you know, this irregular spending gets identified, whether it be in Auditor General reports or elsewhere, that it's acted upon.
And greater transparency in that respect in the allocation and the monitoring of lottery grants, which also seems to fall by the wayside.
I mean, the type of schemes, Jeremy, that we saw in this whole issue, you know, the issue of MPOs that were hijacked, of, projects that were funded, you know, where there's never any delivery on the projects. You know, you would think that, yeah, you know, there'd have to be that kind of scrutiny to all of this. I think a lot of it was the work of the investigative journalists, of Ray Joseph in particular. He was able to uncover a lot of this stuff because some, you know, that there was some brazenness, because, you know, we do have some information, you know, when awards get made in the national lotteries, we can access that information. But absolutely, you know, going forward, there must be much tighter scrutiny around these things in order to ensure that these kind of schemes don't flourish.
I'm going to leave it there. Karam Singh, Executive Director at Corruption Watch, thank you very much indeed for that insight. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's move on to agriculture now, and brace yourselves for a price of 200 Rand for a 10-kilogram bag of potatoes. There are warnings out to this effect, and it's not just our favourite form of carbohydrate that's being impacted by the weather, other vegetables as well. Paul Makube is agriculture economist at FNB and joins me on the programme now. And Paul, given the widespread black frost damage, how severe then do you anticipate the shortage of potatoes is going to be in coming months, and what does this mean for consumers?
Yes, the severity of the situation is that the impacted area is normally at its peak of production during that period. And that's the window for the region, which is Limpopo, which peaks around October, November, you know, rising from September. So expectations are that we're going to see a contraction in supplies out of that region, and that will result in upswing in prices. Industry estimates indicate that there will be a cut, but it's not as massive as initially thought. Indications are that this is just about 7.4 million, 10-kilogram bags that will be lost as a result of, black frost. So that is the extent of the damage. There will be supplies, but it's going to be tight, from September onwards until the cycle turns later.
But we also farm potatoes in other provinces, don't we? Free State and the Western Cape.
Yes, definitely. We actually farm across the country, but the biggest regions are your Free State, Limpopo, and the Western Cape, together accounting for about 17%. And if you look at Limpopo, that is 25% of the planted area and 22% of productions. And as I indicated, they peak supplies during October, November, and then from there it tapers off.
I was going to say, right across the supply chain, from planting to harvesting to putting it onto the supermarket shelf, is this a particularly expensive commodity or vegetable to farm?
Yeah, definitely. It's quite an expensive commodity to farm. You know, the equipment, mostly, 87% and the irrigation that, gives you an extent to which farmers have to put in to actually, produce the crop.
Paul, given that we don't in bulk farm a lot of potatoes in Gauteng, and that obviously transport would be a major factor to the cost, how are consumers in this particular area going to be affected?
Yeah, so when we're talking about the supply of vegetables, across the country, the supplies, the normal, trends will continue that potatoes from Limpopo will reach Johannesburg, will reach Cape Town, and those are the major markets where the farmers supply. So there will still be supplies going to the market. So in terms of costs of transportation will remain almost, trend will be remain the same, except when we either have an increase in fuel costs or a decrease. Fortunately for the consumer, we have seen a decrease recently of fuel costs, and we are likely to see that in September. That should help help the consumer somewhat. But in terms of availability, the price, a few more rands will be added on the back.
And Paul, explain to me how significant the role of imports is. I know that we do bring in frozen fries in an effort to stabilize the local potato market during periods of low supply. To what extent does that help, and what impact does this have on domestic producers?
Yeah, obviously, in terms of competition, imports do compete with local product, especially on the frozen fries. And unfair competition is when low quality and unsolicited imports that may actually hurt the domestic market. And hence, there has been protection put in place to ensure that there is fair, competition, and farmers are protected, from external. Mm-hmm. But obviously, in terms of shortages, severe shortages, then imports, do come in. But mostly, they are, French fries, and to come from mostly Europe. But obviously, that will also come at a bit of a cost, given the current level of prices on the international market as well.
Paul, we've been talking about the short-term situation, but looking longer and perhaps into the medium term, we've also got the La Nina weather pattern, which obviously is going to influence the potato market in terms of supply recovery and price stabilization. So it's not just a short-term issue. We could face a slightly longer-term issue, which would also have an impact on prices.
Well, in terms of long term, currently, this is a weather-induced shortage at the moment. A temporary one. If one looks at this, production cycle, it's not that long. But if you look at the expectations of weather, the indications are that we're going to have normal to above normal rainfall due to the La Nina weather pattern. And if you look at the irrigation water, we are well supplied, over 70% above 70% levels in terms of dams. And we have also had stabilization on the, you know, energy front in terms of electricity supply, which means, you know, irrigation, the farmers will be able to irrigate. So one expects that in 2025 or 6 months' time, we should see a swing back to normal supplies of these vegetables on the market. So this is definitely temporary, and we should see a swing back to normal supplies.
This conversation has largely focused on potatoes, but what other vegetables are also at risk of higher prices?
Yeah, those that were impacted. I mean, we're talking tomatoes as well, and I think also as well, you know, avocados as well. Although the impact on the avocados will be in the next season, because they affected you know, the buds that will bear fruit in for the next cycle. But currently, you know, you have tomatoes. You've got sweet corn, and those are the and some maros that are impacted by the black frost. So already we have seen that, you know, price, you know, increases recently, and this will continue until we are back into the normal production cycle.
So if you were planning an avocado, tomato and potato salad, I would tread very carefully. Paul Makube, thank you very much indeed. Always a pleasure talking to you, agriculture economist at FNB.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Attention, all investors and finance enthusiasts. Get ready for the annual Money Summit, Africa's largest and most influential savings and investment event. Join me, Jeremy Maggs, on Tuesday, the 10th of September at the Sandton Convention Center as we connect with over 100 top chief executives and industry leaders across 20 exciting conferences and forums, all in one incredible day. Secure your spot now. Register online at www.moneysummit.co.za for free with the code MONEYWEBGUEST. This is your chance to be part of Africa's premier savings and investment event. Don't miss it.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
Now, there is nothing quite like an Ellis Park clash between the Springboks and the All Blacks, and we have that to look forward to. But more broadly, though, can we say that we are already in preparation for the next phase? In other words, World Cup 2027, if memory serves. News 24 sports writer Kanyiso Chwaku is with us now. He's been a guest on the program before, and we do appreciate his insight. How crucial and welcome to you is this match against the All Blacks at Ellis Park?
Good afternoon, Jeremy. Good afternoon to the listeners. Very crucial, very crucial. Remember, it is the first All Black Test match after the World Cup final. That's where the last time these teams have met. South Africa have increasingly not done well against All Blacks at Ellis Park. If you look back, the fact that they lost one there against them 10 years ago. So I think they've got one that they need to sort out. And then number two, it's probably one of the teams that they need to beat to show that they aren't just a World Cup team. I think one of the biggest debates around the Springboks has been the inability to dominate in between World Cup years. But I think what has become clear now across the world that teams are building up for the next World Cup. And if every so often you have a slip up here or there in a particular build up here, if you win the World Cup, it doesn't matter. Mm. However, though, what a lot of teams are trying to avoid is having an island kind of run where you are comfortably the most preeminent team in between World Cup years. But you are not able to develop a game, but are unable to get past a World Cup. So remember now, Ireland, for example, went 17 games unbeaten before they met New Zealand in the quarterfinals, and they couldn't get past the quarterfinal. And everyone remembers Ireland for not winning that quarterfinal, and not the fact that they were the best team in between that. Remember, that was an affliction that New Zealand had between 1991 and 2011, where they were comfortably the best rugby team in the world. But Australia, South Africa, and England were interchanged the World Cup without them winning it. So I think what they really, 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 what these teams are looking at now is, yes, they understand the need to win. They understand the need to stamp the dominance as the most preeminent rugby teams in the world. However, on the other hand, they do understand that they also need to make sure that come the next World Cup in Australia, they also put their foot down as the best available sides. But they need to then draw a very thick or thin line, depending on which way you look at it, between performance, a short and mid-term performance, and long-term development for a successful World Cup assault.
Let's not forget the fans baying in the stands, though. So how does Rassie Erasmus balance the need, as you say, to forward plan, build depth, with the insistent pressure from the likes of me to win crucial matches leading up to the World Cup? Or doesn't he mind about it?
The key part is that if you look back at the matches that they've played already, they've already walked that tightrope quite successfully, in that changes were made for the Australia game and they still recorded a significant win. If you look back at the one time that changes weren't made, that's the one game that they lost. That would be the Ireland game. But then again, they lost that game by 1 point, and that had the box made better use of the opportunities, they could have won that game. It was one of those point swings. Now, the colleague noted that at some point the Boks were going to have to be on the receiving end of a 1 point loss, because life does not allow you to ride your luck as much as they did through the World Cup, where they won three consecutive playoff games by 1 point. That luck has to turn on you at some point. Hopefully it does not turn on the Boks again when they play the All Blacks tomorrow. So far, he tries his best to clear that message that we need to win convincingly and develop, because now if you look at the lock development that has been taking place, you realize the fact that now Ron Nokia has to play tomorrow, Ben Jason Dixon has to play tomorrow. These are players who are very new from a playing perspective. They've been in the box setup from a preparation perspective, but they have not been playing. They are not. Last year you wouldn't consider them to be starting Springboks, but now they are, because of a raft of injuries that have afflicted the team. If you look at all the World Cup locks, outside of Marvin Orr, who's not in the squad, the other locks are injured. Ibn Etzebeth was a doubt until Wednesday, when he was twice fit to play. So already you realize that as much as the madness looks clear, but the method is paying off, because now the same players that were being experimented with are now a key part in needing to actually developed are a key part in needing to help bring a win for the box tomorrow.
Well, let's see how it all plays out. I always appreciate that crisp analysis from News 24 rugby sports writer Kaniso Chwaku. I do appreciate your time. Just before I say goodbye to you, on our last online poll, and it related to the interview I did yesterday with the Transport Minister Barbara Creasy, and also our conversation today with ATNS, outdated instrument flight procedures. My question to you: how often are you experiencing flight delays? I gave you two options: not a lot or more than usual. And 73% of our respondents saying that they are seldom experiencing flight delays. So I guess that is a piece of good news. That's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening. Goodbye and have a good weekend.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.